I don't know what you're doing, Dan. Why are you Why are you breaking your computer right now?
Breaking it all day long.
Should we get the satellite out so that we can talk over lasers bounced off of satellites?
Just don't anger me, or I'll shoot your satellite with a laser.
Spoiler alert, Dan.
Microphone level looks really low. Hang on a second.
Yeah, well, that's what I was trying to tell you before.
I know what it was. I zapped a PRAM the other day, and it reset my USB mic input level.
Oh, okay. There you
go.
That
should be good.
All right.
Sound better?
Yes.
Okay, good.
So, back to bouncing lasers off of satellites, which, you know, is a good way to video conference with people. From the fine company that has been made up for the movie. And like you said, you know, you can use the laser with a special diamond that has all of the 12 gigawatt chip power to channels to blow up the thing. Anyway, I don't care that spoils the movie for anyone, because you shouldn't watch this.
No, this movie is bad. This movie is very, very bad.
So if you are at all like, oh no, I better not listen to this Defocused episode because I might eventually get around to seeing the movie. No, just stop that.
I mean, it's bad in a way that you could probably turn it into a drinking game or something.
Sure. I could see that. Like, every time there's let's see, what would you say? Every time
I would go with like dissolves or like random footage of nature, or actually, you know, it would be great. You know, anytime there's like a travel sequence where there's a bunch of series of shots with slow dissolves where people are just going from one place to another.
I don't know what you're talking about, Dan. They just get so swiftly from A to B in this film.
Right, right. I mean, the opening scene is just cars driving through the desert. And then dissolve to cars driving through the desert for a while.
And then...
Then they hike through the jungle and stuff.
Congo.
Surprise the Congo.
Really sneaks up on you. Especially when you do most of your filming not in the Congo. But, yeah, it's wow, it's a thing. Yeah, I guess you could drink every time there's one of those dissolves and a montage. You'd be very drunk, but... What about, like, two shots every time Dylan Walsh says he's going to go his own way, or he's bailing on something? Because I think that is quite possibly one of my favorite things about this, is you have this incredibly unlikable protagonist who is constantly trying to sabotage everything. And not in a way that would, like, help himself or the movie be any better in any way. So it's like adds another layer of unlikability, because like, could you imagine if any of those times he had said no, we're going my own way? It's just been a whole movie about him trying to go back to America.
I know we made it all the way to Tanzania over here, wherever they were at that point in the movie, but I know at this point I'm over my head, so I need to back out, man. I need to go home. I give up now. It's like, well, you're in the middle of nowhere. You just jumped out of an airplane and you watched it explode. Like, what? How do you imagine you're just going to go home now?
Yeah, he's...
I want to go home. I want my mommy. Well, the airplane just blew up and you jumped out of an airplane with a parachute.
Yeah.
With a supposedly drugged gorilla hanging on to...
Well, they put the dope in the banana.
Put a pill in it. They tore a banana in half and stuck a pill in it.
Yeah, and you saw how many bananas they had in the banana carrying case.
Right. There's a lot of cinematic shorthand used in this movie, and it's all very bad. Very, very bad.
Uh-huh. By shorthand, you mean scribbles on the back of a napkin? Because this is just like, in terms of like movie making expertise, this is not even like competently made, but with like a shoddy script or something like that. This is just like bad throughout. There is incompetence at every level. The action scenes are like completely deflated by the way that they're shot. there are moments of where a character is supposed to be developing a relationship with another character, and it's like after somebody just died 2 seconds ago. Like, it is an amazing, fascinating study in sort of a crass commercial product where some executives at Paramount were like, hey, that Universal movie, You know, that one with the dinosaurs. You know, it was by, what's that guy's face? Chris Mikton. Yeah, get me one of his books. Yeah, let's get one of them. Turn that into a movie. There's another company and some other stuff, and there's this thing, whatever. Just make it about diamonds. And then lasers. And gorillas. Oh, you can't do CG gorillas? Okay, well, hire that Stan Winston guy, and we'll make him do animatronic gorillas. Make the camera really close on him, because that'll be dramatic. Okay? Now, do that for the whole running time of this film. We can't get Steven Spielberg, so let's get this Frank Marshall guy who's he's buddies with or something, and then we'll get Jerry Goldsmith, because we can't get John Williams. And it's just like, you guys, no, stop. And they're like, oh, Dennis Nedry, he had a fun Hawaiian shirt, and he was cracking jokes. Let's get Joe Pantoliano and put him in a fun Hawaiian shirt and make him crack jokes. You watch this movie and you're just like, this is someone trying to take sort of these things from Jurassic Park, like commercially and formulaically, and then just botching it. It is amazing.
Yeah, you can definitely see how it was a Crichton novel, and then how they had to condense it into an hour and 40-minute movie, and then how they just like. I guess they like couldn't figure out how to make some stuff interesting, so the stuff that like filled the time is, like we said, just travel montages where they're inflating boats and then singing California Dreamin' and then floating down a river and floating down a river some more, and then there's a hippo, and it's like, why does this take so much? Like, I think that floating down the river scene with the hippo took as long as like the entire climax of this movie. It was just no reason. Just completely poorly timed.
Worst Jungle Cruise ever.
All the leaves are brown and the sky is gray. I've been for a walk on a winter's day. I'll say walk if I was in L.A.
If I was in L.A.
California dreaming
for such a winter's day.
Disney would fire them.
At least they got to see a hippo up close. Mm-hmm. Not everybody gets to see that.
Yeah, well, hippos are very dangerous, Dan.
Yeah,
for good reason.
Which is why you should slow down your boat and like hold your flares very near the water and look around like you're looking for something, even though you don't know what's out there.
Yes, yes, exactly. And you should definitely have only one hippo, because that's all you can afford. And you should film it. Should film it basically with a black backdrop on some water, because you can't actually film it under any other conditions, and it'll be really intense and dramatic for 2 seconds, but slow it down more.
No, it wasn't intense or dramatic.
Yeah,
it's just a hippo.
So terrible. But we should probably get back to the Jungle Cruise of this movie, the start with the turnstiles,
turnstiles
as it were, where we are led into the ride with Bruce Campbell. So he was in this.
Yeah, he goes hiking in the jungle. He was in it briefly, and he sets up a nice little satellite radio chat to talk to his folks. There's a lot of montage, a lot of driving, and then hiking, and music mm-hmm. only, and no talking. Mm-hmm. And then my favorite part is right after they do all of the like hiking through the jungle montage, there is literally a cut to space where we see a satellite.
Yeah, it's like all of a sudden it's real genius.
Sure. It's like, oh, cool, we're going on this long, long trip here in the Congo, because the movie's called Congo. Then you'll never see this coming. Cut to space.
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 And then cut to where was their satellite dish location thing?
Texas.
Yeah,
it was
okay.
In Texas.
Yeah. So they had their dishes all pointed up at the things, and we couldn't afford Jodie Foster, so we got Laura Linney. she's there.
It's a very secure facility, because she tries her card key and the other guy's like, nah, he already changed the code. He's got the old man's got me changing it every 2 hours. So to make sure we're extra secure, we're in this tiny little conference room with glass windows that basically anyone walking by can see what's going on inside. That's how security works.
Yeah, and you could hear the passcode because he has to say it. So What is this even supposed to be? Like, is this supposed to be for comedy? Because it wasn't funny. And then it somehow, like, takes up time. So it's in there because they thought it was interesting on some level. And not only was that interesting and supposedly funny, but they even revisit that after Bruce Campbell dies rather spectacularly at the beginning by her trying to leave the room, and she can't get out, and she wants to know the passcode to get out, but it's already changed. And it's just like...
First of all, who locks people in a room? Like... we're really concerned about security here, so we can't let you out of this room because you have the information. So basically, you have to stay in this room for the rest of your life, because if you go outside, you might tell somebody. Like, what's the thought there?
Well, you see, when the guy who owns the company starts a fire in the room, then you want to make sure no one can leave, but yeah, they can grab the fire extinguisher.
He's the rich guy who owns the company because he rode in on a golf cart and he was holding like a chipping wedge. He carries around a golf club with him, and he uses it to smash in 14-inch Sony Trinitron monitors that are lining their special room that catch fire and don't electrocute him for some reason. Mm-hmm. But then he demands that Dr. Karen Ross, Laura Linney, put out the fire with the fire extinguisher rather than leave the room and do her job, because he's in charge. Apparently, he's a moron.
Yeah. So CIA Jack Wade from GoldenEye and Tomorrow Never Dies is here as the boss. And
oh, right, that's where he's from.
Yeah. That's, and those were, even Tomorrow Never Dies was a better movie than this. but he's supposed to be this unlikable, greedy, completely unrealistic cartoon of a human being.
Well, you can tell he's a rich guy because he has two first initials and no first name, R.B. Travis.
I thought that's how you could tell he was from Texas.
Oh, that, no, I think that's just like Texas oil magnate guy. Like, I'm rich old money guy. We don't have real names. We have initials.
Yeah.
I'm going to start going by D.C. Sturm. Like, I'm not going to have a real name anymore. Just call me DC. How you doing? Just a chipping wedge. I like to hit balls in between smashing TVs with a golf club.
Okay, DC.
Thank you. Wait. Was that the guy who hijacked the airplane in the 70s? No, it was DB. DB Cooper. Never mind. Okay, I'm good. I'll stick with it.
I was going to say, that sounds like DC.
Yeah, I'm just curious what the SEO is going to be on DC.
Something tells me it'll be a Washington. So
there's the video chat, and Bruce Campbell calls and he's like, look at us, we found blue diamonds, they're 100% pure and they're amazing and blah blah blah, and they're exactly what you need. I'm gonna stick them in this laser gun and shoots a laser into the trees, because apparently pure diamonds are the secret to powerful lasers for the communications industry.
Well, not only that, Dad, but it is a sample, an unrefined pure sample. How can that even be a thing?
It's pure diamond, but he didn't bother to wash it off in the creek to get the dust off it or something. I don't know.
Look up how you get a diamond out of the ground in this film?
No, they're just like, well, they would probably just be laying in the dirt, right? Yeah. That's how diamonds happen, right? You don't have to like...
Just rub it on your shirt, put it in a laser.
Spoiler, laser. The diamond mine is just like an orange sandy beach with diamonds sitting in. Not even diamonds. They're basically like quartz, but still.
Yeah. I was gonna say an orange soundstage, but
well, yes, of course.
The whole premise basically is that this company.
Well, this is the initial premise, okay. Not the premise for the movie. There are numerous premises.
Well,
stay off the premises.
You want to stay away from the perimeter alarms. And
sure, it's the tripwire that knocks you down a hill and then just sets off a very quiet alarm.
Yes.
Wah, wah. Like, oh, that's going to wake me up.
God, it's so ridiculous.
We're literally 2 minutes into this movie, and this episode's going to be... Joe, we talk for so long. We already talk for so long. We are the longest incomparable podcast per episode average, and we're going to do it again.
Well, something tells me there's going to be a large portion of this film we can just skip right past.
I'm not sure there is. I want to talk about a lot of these details.
Oh, okay, DC. So, The
thank you for adopting that so quickly.
Oh, it's the rest of the show, Dan. Maybe even the rest of your life. Oh wait, I meant to say DC. Forget that part. Where I said Dan.
It's okay. We're old friends. You can call me by my former name before I made my transition into rich Texas magnate.
Oh God. The whole thing here is that he's got this pure diamond that he shoots this laser with, and none of this is how lasers work, or diamonds or communications or anything. But he sets fire to a tree, and they're all like, "Oh, this is so great! We're gonna set
up."
I'm
okay with making the assumption that whatever laser technology they're developing relies on pure diamonds to create a powerful beam, and that is his demonstration, because we don't really need to dwell on that for very long.
Well, except for the fact that why would they have even made a guess that this location had what they were looking for?
That's backstory we don't need. That's the legend of Solomon City or whatever it's called.
But they didn't. The telecommunications company didn't know that.
You don't know. The golfer guy, he could be a polymath. He could be familiar with lore and legend. And
But he didn't want to tell Karen, because Karen might get away with the secrets, and she couldn't even be trusted with the passcode. So he
was. Yeah, I mean, you know, just hiking around through some place in the Congo where near a volcano, and we have some suspicions that's, you know, once we confirm that in fact that is where the diamonds are, then we can start to let people in. But we don't want to ruffle any feathers and letting people know that we're looking for pure diamonds in Solomon's cityscape or whatever, because we might not find anything.
Yeah, so this is short-lived, because they're going to go set up their base camp or whatever. And they're supposed to go check in and stuff.
Call you back in an hour. I really want the other guy to be here, because he deserves some credit, because not only is this phone call update with his boss, it's apparently also an award recognition ceremony or something. So,
well, not just with his boss, but as we come to find out in a short bit, it's his dad.
Oh, right, sure.
Yeah, and also the former ex... I don't understand how this... Technically, they weren't super clear in the movie about the levels of formerness and whatnot, but they almost married to Laura Linney's character.
Right, that's one of those things that she shouts in that scene where they're just going through exposition as fast as they can, and they say it really loud, so we're not supposed to notice that it's very very poorly done.
Yes, and she also says it later on to Dylan Walsh when he's hitting on her, and they're in mortal danger. The thing is that...
Call you back in an hour. And then he finds the other guy, and he's all wet. He's like, "Hey, man, come check this thing out. Jump in this little mini lake here next to the volcano." He's like, "What? Why would I do that?" He's like, "Come on, I want to show you something." And he jumps in, and he very slowly, awkwardly flounder swims his way through this little tiny hole over on the far side there. And Bruce Campbell's like, "Well, I guess I'll go with you. I could use a swim." Puts down his bag, and then he very slowly, awkwardly swims. Like, why would we actually watch somebody in real time swim 25 feet? Like, that is not a fast process. Just cut to the other side. Anyway.
This was poorly scripted and poorly directed. There's no reason for that to have occurred. It could have been, "Hey, come check out this thing." And then he pulls aside some palm fronds, and then, "Oh crap, a secret ape city." But they don't do that. They're just like, "We need to have the swimming sequence." And it's like, "Well, is there anything dramatic about the swimming sequence?" "No, there's just water." Okay, well
you know, it's there's the little hidden tunnel that it's kind of out of the way, but as soon as you see that setup,
there is nothing dramatic about that sequence, Dan.
Well, as soon as you see the little tiny bit of sunlight streaming in through the hole in the rock face, barely poking out of the water, you're like, "Oh, there's a tunnel over there. You should totally go through that."
Yeah.
So
yeah, like the 5 feet away. And so they go through it, and they find the stuff, and then they're all hanging out, and they're like, "Time to go back," or whatever, blah, blah, blah.
From above, it just looks like jungle, but it's not just jungle. There's all these buildings and temples and faces carved out of stone, and look at all this overgrown, and look how awesome it is. Like, "Well, okay, this is cool. We got to go call Dad, so let's get out of here." He's like, "Cool, I'm going to go get my backpack," which apparently I set down inside one of these buildings very far away, because That's what you do, right? When you first explore something that you've never, some place that you've never been before, you set your bag down so that you know where it is and you were exploring before or something. You don't just carry it around with you. These guys are not great with the exploring and or camping.
No. He should have kept his eye on it.
Yeah, because Bruce Campbell sits down on the stairs waiting for him rather than going in with him and starts to eat a candy bar. He goes, come on, buddy. We're going to be late. We got to call Dad in 10 minutes. And then somebody throws something through the foliage at him. And he goes, boy, you're throwing stuff at me now. And he picks it up, and it's a bloody eyeball. And his friend is dead. And he doesn't run away. He just kind of sits there and looks at the eyeball and slowly turns around and then presumably gets killed.
And screams. It is really dumb. And then, shortly after this, they're like, oh, he didn't check in. Well, he did say he was going to go find the other guy. Maybe he's just not back yet. Oh, well, we better panic and turn on the camera. So they panic
let's remotely
turn
on the camera from the other side of the world and just start panning around and looking at things.
Yeah, and they had the little axis dome thing with the sphere projection of what it was seeing relative to itself. It was interesting.
They predicted the drop cam back in 1995.
Yeah, so they are looking around, and they're like, oh, crap, we should have turned on a canary sooner, because we can totally see that something bad has happened here. There's been a home intrusion. And so there's
dead bodies everywhere, and the camp is trashed, and
and then they turn on predator vision to confirm the heat signatures. They're like,
well, like there's like a loud thing rushing past the camera and like, oh, what was that? Maybe now we should like turn on the thing and look around. And what do they say? They count seven dead bodies or something. And then something rushing past knocks over the camera, because apparently, you know, the motion spooked it. And I like how they cut back to the little 3D diagram of the camera to show you like how it's falling over for some reason.
Yeah, well, it, you know, that was important. It has its own story too. You know, it's got to tell its story. It's got to have its acting moment. It has been slain. But so anyway, this sets up that there are these gray gorillas. Now, how they knew that the gorillas were gray and not just like some exposure problem, I have no idea, because the video output on that thing is not great.
Well, but, I mean, it had scan lines, but I'm sure they properly white and black balanced it.
Oh, of course. So after they had properly set the color temperature and everything, they had determined that the ape was exactly 0.18 gray, and so they decide that they need to send an expedition right away, because there might still be somebody alive and they should save them. And
you gotta go in there and get them. Find an exposition that's already on its way, and we'll get you there. Which this part is sort of reveals itself later, that they're trying to keep her mission on the down low by piggybacking off somebody else's expedition to the Congo. But in this instance, it's just like, do you not know how to like call a travel agent, book a flight to the Congo? Like, why are you, what are you talking about, man? Like, this is in the shouty exposition scene after he hits the TV with the golf club, where it's just like, what, you know, go on an expedition or find something that's already on its way. Like, what are you talking about? Just put her on a plane and send her to the Congo. Why are you doing this fake secrecy thing? None of this makes sense. It's just diamonds. Who cares?
Well,
the diamonds are the future.
Lots of people care about diamonds, Dan. Who cares?
Sure.
So DC, they make these all this convoluted stuff because he's also concerned that if the government finds out that people have been killed and that they're sending in a second mission, that it will draw undue attention and close the borders or whatever. But they close the borders anyway, so it doesn't matter. I think this is probably one of those things where in the book they didn't want the company they were competing against to know that they had sent another expedition. I'm guessing. I haven't read the book. But the fact that there's no other company, it seems like the only reason for this could possibly be like corporate espionage or something like that. Now, as we saw in The Martian, it's awfully hard to mount a second probe when the first probe fails. So you usually have to coordinate with somebody else, get their probe, piggyback on their probe.
So you're saying that they should have gone the other direction and sort of slingshot the plane around the other side of the globe, like over Asia, and then come into Africa on the other side?
Yeah, they should have tunneled from China through to the Congo.
See, they never would have seen that coming. That would have been great.
That would have worked out fantastic.
They can close all the borders they want when you're drilling right through the center of the earth.
Yeah, well, that's the core. That's a different movie. But
I was going to say, what kind of apparatus would one need to drill through the core of the earth, Joe?
Let's not talk about that. It has diamond tips, and it's on the drilly things. And
would one potentially need to bring a nuclear explosive device to restart the cores of the earth?
Yeah, well, you see, it's all about the magnetic field of the Congo.
Sure.
God.
If you set up an explosion in the Congo and then catch all of the diamonds that are flying on your way out, you'll be fine. You won't die.
We're like making bad movie soup right now.
This movie is already bad movie soup.
No, but it's like we reheated it and then we put other leftover soup in it. We were just like, hey, this is the dregs. Let's add some more dregs.
It's like if you have two different brands of like store-bought canned minestrone, and you're just like, well, I don't have enough for one bowl, so let's just mix them together and shake them around and throw some crackers on there, and it'll be fine.
I was gonna go with like, you know, chicken and stars or something like really lackluster, where you'd be like, why would anyone even make this? You know.
It's like if you mix the chicken and stars in like a vegetable medley or something that just didn't even work at all together.
or like a Dentymore stew, where it's just like, was this from a cow? Like, I couldn't tell you. maybe this was just a racer meat grown out of the ground. But the whole point...
Sounds delicious.
It is. The reason why they call it Dentymore is because you want more, please. You don't... spoiler alert, and also please don't mix that with your vegetable medley and your chicken and stars.
This is not a cooking show.
Thank god. So they do the things with the stuff, and she makes she's going to make her arrangements. End scene. Then we cut to
Berkeley, slow panning entrance to the scene, similar to the opening of like Back to the Future. And there's drawings everywhere, and somebody is playing Wolfenstein on a monitor, but there's nobody there, so...
I thought that was Doom.
Sure. No, that was totally Castle Wolfenstein, or whatever the actual name is.
Okay.
You know, it's 1995. That's how you do. And then there's a gorilla painting on stuff with her fingers,
well,
mostly
you see,
painting on her shirt.
No, but you see the finger paintings... that she's done already first. You don't
sure,
know.
Sure, it's mostly trees and stuff.
It looks like you're in a child's room, basically. Yes. And there are all these paintings and stuff. And almost all of them are green and look like, I guess, rudimentary brush or foresty stuff. And then a couple of them have, like, these yellow circles and stuff. It kind of looks like a snake eye, basically, on some of these things. And so you pan across all of this stuff and go over, like, the crayon oversized thing, and there's smudges and whatever, and then we reveal that it's a puppet operated with a person inside, and we are introduced to the first animatronic main character, and I guess the only one. I don't know, it depends on how you want to categorize Ernie Wilson's performance, I guess, but there's Richard, who is helping Amy with her stuff, and then Dylan Walsh comes in and he's like, okay, time to go, Amy. It's time for my presentation thing now with the stuff and the things. And we go to his class where he's teaching, well, I guess lecture, where he's explaining his research and doing it with footage of some MIT experiment where they are able to interpret sign language based on a special glove. And so they use this to allow for a human to speak. We see this on the footage that he has. And then we have him bring in Amy, the ape, who has a glove of her own, and she speaks and answers questions. And they have a little exchange. And there is some audience members who are enamored by this.
Yeah, it's a lecture hall at Berkeley. And he's got a grant from the school, apparently, to do this research. But the people in the audience are basically, what, like venture capitalists or something? Like, it's not a class of students, and we're not entirely clear as to what he's doing there.
There's that one character actor guy who is talking to his lady friend, and they appear to be from, like, Hollywood or something, and they want to, like, turn this into an attraction or something like that. I don't even know why that was in the movie, because then I started thinking, wow, I totally don't remember them being in the rest of the film. And then I was like, oh, they just had that there for no reason. That was
this. The gorilla is talking. The gorilla is talking. Well, not
like
really.
Mr.
It's
Ed.
Doing, it's doing. Yeah, it's not like yeah. Mr. Ed. It's doing sign language. Mm. It's the machine's just translating the sign language. So the feat is they taught a gorilla sign language, which is a thing that has happened theoretically. But this is the part like we're again. This is like what the third like second and a half scene. You're like. There's diamonds and lasers, and now we're in Berkeley with a talking gorilla, and he's... I guess, whatever, I'm here, I'm sitting in the chair. What more do you have for me, movie?
Well, this is the part where it's, like, really Crichton-y, is just, like, you know, science, the magic of science, and nature, and humans and nature working together to learn. So... great. And we also get to see Tim Curry, who is in the audience. And
he's holding some ancient book.
Uh-huh.
And he's okay, so this is the part. Did I miss the part where he's like, "Oh, fascinating." And then he pulls his little like ancient Solomon temple ring out of the book and puts it on and looks at it. Like he was looking at the little symbol of the eye on his ring, as we come to learn later, and comparing it to the drawings that Amy the monkey was making. But how did he see the drawings? Was it in the film or something? Because he didn't go like back in her little lair there.
Later on, when he's on the boat explaining to Ernie Hudson why he did this, why he thinks Amy is connected to the city of Zinj, he pulls out this magazine like page that's been crumpled up and folded a thousand times into his stuff, and that is his only clue. Is this like, I guess, photo from some terrible science journal or something like that, where she's with one of her drawings and it has the yellow oval and line through it like an eye, just like on his ring. Except,
sure, that makes sense.
Except it could be like literally for any reason at all. Like there's nothing really that specific about that symbol.
Well, when you're at the intersection of gorillas and eye-shaped drawings, there are limited possibilities there.
Well, except he didn't know he was at that intersection because he didn't know anything about gorillas being involved in this at all.
It's the Congo. It's a legitimate bet that there might be gorillas related to it. He's basically saying the gorilla has seen this symbol before and is from there. So when he finds out that they want to take the gorilla back there, which he didn't really...
No.
Know about, because that didn't come out of Dylan Walsh's mouth until later.
No, but so he okay. He was just there at the lecture to survey what was happening and to try and figure out what
you're just saying he randomly caresses his ancient ring and book from time to time for no reason whatsoever?
No, I think he was totally doing that because he was like, "Oh, Amy, oh, my little ring thing." Now, I think it would have been like 5,000 times better if they had actually had some of her drawings in there at least, because
it would have made a lick of sense.
Yeah,
if he would have seen the drawing and gone like, "Hey, wait a minute," but like,
it's sort of this cartoonish kind of I have a ring to stroke my special box, and then he goes.
They should have like done a little bit more dramatic lighting, like darkened all of him except like a little slit of light right across his eyes.
Oh god!
And then do like a slow push into his face.
This
like,
isn't,
that would
this
be the only
the
way.
Shadow.
The only way it would be a more dramatic reveal that he is potentially a sneaky, underhanded character.
I mean, Tim Curry was also in the shadow, but so.
Tim Curry's great. Oh, there was also the first time.
No. Wait. I really like Tim Curry. I think Tim Curry is fantastic in almost everything, except this accent is ungodly terrible.
No, the accent is pretty awful.
And who are you, sir? Herkimer Homolka, formerly of Romania, free now of the chains of Ceausescu, traveling the world, doing good.
I mean, this is one of those things where there is no excuse for this, because this is not a comedy, and
well,
so you can't.
He's got to be Romanian or something.
But it's or something like whatever that is. It is just awful beyond belief. It is worse than Red October stuff that he was doing. Like I just don't understand where this motivation came from to affect this accent. Now, quite possibly they were like, oh, it's really important that this character be Romanian because it's really integral to this. But then
I think, I think they just basically said, when in doubt, what did the book say about this character? Well, that's do what the book says because you gotta stay true to the source material. But as we've discussed in the past, Tim Curry just has a Tim Curry accent. He doesn't have a regular accent that you can place anywhere. So they could have just let him talk the way he normally talks and everyone would be like, oh, sure, he's from Romania.
Yeah, well, I mean, he could have, like, gone to school in England or something. It doesn't make any sense. Like,
No. The guy in the book didn't go to school in England, so he can't do that.
But
this movie definitely suffers from what did they do in the book?
Let's just stick to that. They did not do that, because this apparently was heavily criticized for veering away from the book at many parts. Like, Ernie Hudson's character is supposed to be half Scottish and is supposed to have a strong Scottish accent.
Well, he has some kind of accent, too.
No, he has some kind of accent, but it is not,
my favorite thing about Ernie Hudson's accent is that, like, half the time, he's thinking so hard about doing the accent that it totally takes, like, the incorrect emotional inflection when he's trying to say something that's supposed to be, like, dramatic or sort of, like, down. It basically sounds like he's saying, like, oh, jolly good. And it's like, no, you're not supposed to, you're supposed to, like, be sad at this point or, like, angry at this point.
It's like he's in a community production of The Great Gatsby, and it's just like, my dear boy, like, because it's just like it's oh god, the accents in this film, I just don't understand what they were thinking. It is funny in a way that is unintentionally entertaining to make fun of. It is not at all funny in the context of the film. Like, none of the characters are aware of how ridiculous they sound to one another, or comment on it. It's just preposterous. So it's bad movie making. And yes.
While we're talking about Ernie Hudson, before we jump away, can I just mention that, like, I know we're going to get to it here shortly, and there's some more to talk about with Amy before we get on there, but I love his introduction because he just, like, gets out of a car and he shakes some hands. And then there's a truck, like, literally just driving by. And it could totally drive by. But he pulls out a gun and points it at the driver. And for some reason, the driver stops. Like, when somebody points a gun at you while you're driving, your instinct is to stop rather than just keep driving away. No. But he points a gun at the driver, he stops, and the guy gets out of the car and puts his hands up. He's like, go on, get out of here. And there's a nice, funny little moment where the guy doesn't, like, know to run away, and then he runs away. But, like, why? Why did any of that happen? Oh, my God.
I can't tell if you want me to talk about that scene that hasn't happened yet in the film or if we were actually going.
No, we'll get to it in a minute. So basically, when we first saw Amy, we also got the introduction from Dylan Walsh that, did she have any nightmares last night? How'd she do last night? Like, no nightmares last night. So great. She's going to be super prepped and ready for your demo today. And then afterward, when he's saying that all of her drawings, you know, now that I think about it, all of these drawings that she's drawing are of the jungle. She wants to go back to the jungle. She's probably kind of lonely. She hasn't been to the jungle. And then shortly thereafter, we get some more exposition that, you know, that there have been studies that gorillas kept in captivity eventually start to lose their minds and they have to be put down and stuff. So we got to totally take her back to the jungle. And then the college administrator guy's like, what are you talking about? We're not in the business of paying you to take her back to the jungle and give away your research. So that's not going to happen. Enter Tim Curry with his terrible accent going, hey, I'll totally pay for your trip back to the Congo because I'm a philanthropist and I want to do that. And they just kind of look at each other and shrug and they're like, all right, cut to airport. And they're loading up and going.
Well, you say enter Tim Curry like there was a room they were in.
No, they're outdoors sitting at a table having lunch. And he just sort of like strolls past like he was there the whole time. Like, excuse me, I was hiding behind this tree very near you and I heard what your conversation was going on here.
It's silly. And so they work out a deal where he's going to get the ape back to the Congo because he's very concerned and he's a philanthropist from Romania. And blah, blah, blah. Bullshit. And it is very clear to everyone in the audience that this person is not any of these things. So, except maybe, I guess, in the context of the story, he's Romanian. But it's so absurd. They go to the airport thing, and there's the whole thing about the money, and he can't secure the funds to do the thing.
And also we got that really like creepy before they get ready to pack and go. Amy starts yelling "Tickle me," and Dylan Walsh starts tickling the gorilla,
mm-hmm.
which is look creepy. But yeah, that's a minor point, but it's just one of the one of the wrong ingredients to throw into this stew again. But yeah, they're at the he's going to pay for everything because he just wants to explore, and he's a philanthropist. But yeah, they're loading the plane, and then they're unloading the plane because he paid for the flight, but he can't pay for the gas, and the gas is $50,000. In walks Laura Linney, and she's all like, "Yeah, I gotta be on your trip." And he's like, I don't want you on my trip. I don't need you on my trip because I'm a doctor professor guy, and I can't be bought or whatever. And then Tim Curry gives the bad news. Why are you unloading the plane? I can't tell you why we're unloading the plane. Ask the supervisor. You can't tell me why we're unloading the plane? No, we need to pay $56,000 for the gas. And Laura Linney's like, you need me. And then, okay, they get on the plane. That whole scene didn't need to be there at all, aside from introducing Laura Linney to Dylan Walsh and having Amy get jealous that there's a woman there.
Well, it needed to be there to explain that she had the money to secure the funding so that he had to work with this person he didn't know. So it's not completely worthless for it to be there.
I mean, they could just both be on the next plane out to the Congo, and he'd be like, hey,
no, but
what are you doing
she
here?
She doesn't have an expedition that she is a part of, and so she's...
I know, but she could just, like, hide in the plane with him, and he wouldn't really know the difference. He's not really that bright.
It's the point is not to get just her there by herself. She needs people with her. Who's going to carry all of her stuff? So the thing is that she needs to go with somebody else, and so that's why she is going with this expedition, and she gets them to agree to it because she's offering them money. Now, why they didn't ask any follow up questions like, why are you giving us this money? And who do you work for? It's a little weird. But they get on the plane. They give Amy a martini because that's hilarious for some reason.
She's allowed to have one to calm her nerves because as they take off, she keeps saying, ground where? Ground where? Well, it's down there. Apparently, she has really good depth perception and she can tell that they're off the ground.
Yeah. So...
Oh, no, don't forget she gets an egg for putting her seatbelt on because she watches everyone else and puts her seatbelt on. And then she throws the egg at Laura Linney because, you know, she's jealous.
Okay. Dan, we are 45 minutes into this, and I just want to get at least a little further along in the film. You don't have to say every little thing that happens.
She throws an egg at somebody.
But like, that's not even comedy gold to make fun of.
None of this is. It's all on the same level.
Okay, so they arrive to an airport that looks dusty, and then there's a burn-in on the bottom of the screen that says location, Central Africa, because that's not... it's so vague. Like, that's... I mean, you might as well just say, like, location, America. Like,
wherever there happens to be a coup in Africa at any given time, you can just use your imagination and put it there.
The colonialism runs pretty strong in this film, because they land, and then it's like, LOL jokes at the governments falling over all the time, and...
Hide everybody in the back of a truck. Yeah, so we don't get killed.
And Joe Pantoliano.
Sure, he's there, mm-hmm. Saying things and walking around, and there's people blowing stuff up and things.
Mm-hmm. And then Ernie Hudson's there. Like you said, there's this weird scene where he pulls the gun on the guy, steals the truck, puts them in the truck. They drive through the town where stuff is just burning. And then... it's just like, okay, so you got stopped, and now you're going to have a scene where you're all captured, and they're all taken to different places, and Laura Linney and Ernie Hudson go to where the guy who's running the current coup is with Tim Curry, but for some reason the other guys are taken to some scene that seems to be played for comedy about the security interrogation stuff where it's just like, tell me who Kafka is, and it's like, that's not a joke. Like, what is the punchline there? This is just, it's so sad. They have the exchange where he's like, please sit, have coffee and cake. And he's like, please sit, have coffee and cake. And then he gets very angry at Tim Curry for actually eating the cake. And Tim Curry looks at the cake like he's never seen cake before. And like,
he holds it with like both hands right in front of his face. It takes the most awkward bite. He's just sort of like,
it's like
staring
he's
at it.
It's
like
he's
drunk.
A gerbil, and he's like trying to figure out like just like take a tiny little bite, and then just like put it into like the cheek on the side or something like that. Because then later on, in like 2 seconds, the guy's like, "Stop eating my sesame cake," and so he spits out the sesame cake back into his hand that he has not actually like chewed. He just had it in the side of his mouth, and he has the rest of the cake.
Well, stop eating my sesame cake. Stop eating my sesame cake.
Mm-hmm. It's so strange. Now Tim Curry is giving his full Tim Curry, but like it totally, it's just so bizarre. And there's also the bribing the government officials, because you need to do that.
She hands him two giant stacks of cash. The guy's like, more, and he hands two more giant stacks of cash, and he's like,
that was three.
That'll do. It was a three more. Yeah. But that's the instance where somebody would just go like, cool, you have a lot of cash in your bag there. We're just going to shoot you and take it all now. But no, it's apparently he's very diplomatic about it all.
Oh, yeah, I was going to say, he's so respectful of her personal space and her personal items, because he knows that she literally has bundles of cash in a bag.
This would be the scene where
he could push her over and run out the door with it.
Yeah, this is the scene where a screenwriter, a slightly better screenwriter, would take all of their supplies and all of their money and leave them stranded in the jungle. And now they have actually something to overcome along with get to their goal. So that would be interesting to see. But no, there's just this scene with Tim Curry eating sesame cake and her putting stacks of money on the table, and then they leave. And then she pretends to untie Dylan Walsh's hands, who he's just holding his hands behind his back, and then they leave. So that was there for some reason.
Yeah. They get on another airplane, and they're going to go fly over the border, which they can't get into, so that they can go get they can go find the people. And she's been tracking the power signature, whatever, from the laser battery thing this whole time. And so they start flying. They have a little chit-chat about stuff, and we come to find out that Ernie Hudson recognizes Tim Curry's character, and that he's actually this one guy who went on an expedition one time, and it went really badly, and he had to actually pull Tim Curry out of there. And four people were shot, but they didn't know how. And Tim Curry's like, oh, it was terrible suicide. Tim Curry probably shot him. But things are tense and weird. And then all of a sudden they're shot at by heat-seeking RPGs as they fly over the border.
Don't forget the great shot of the close-up of the breaking the banana in half and putting the pill in there. But yeah, you gotta drug that gorilla. But then there's heat-seeking RPGs coming at him, and Laura Linney, with her former CIA training, goes and grabs a flare gun and literally kicks the door open on the airplane and starts shooting the flares at the RPGs to blow them up before they get near the airplane.
Yes.
And, of course, Ernie Hudson grabs another flare gun and joins in.
My favorite part of this is that there were, like, I don't know, five RPGs which have gone off apparently either very close to or on the actual plane itself, according to how dramatic they try to play it with the pilots, where they're like, oh no, we've been hit, we can't take another one like that, blah blah blah. And it's like, how could you take any of them? Like,
well, the first one's like they're trying to do like a submarine thing where they blow up very near the airplane and kind of damage it but don't actually hit it. Like the first couple shots you see the guy is shooting it off from the ground, and it blows up like mid-air near the airplane, which is not remotely how RPGs work, but sure, that's fine, I guess.
Oh, and do you know who one of the pilots was, Dan?
No.
Do you want to guess?
No.
I'll give you a hint. It's definitely not the Congo in Paradise.
What?
He likes his lettuce and tomato.
No, he's not in this.
Yeah, it was Jimmy Buffett is listed in the credits.
I am scrolling where? Wait, I didn't think we even saw the pilots.
is listed as 727 pilot.
Oh my God, you're right, there he is. Why? Jimmy Buffett ruins.
And he had that ridiculous handlebar mustache.
Michael Crichton. See, he was in Jurassic World and he ruined that, and he's in this and he ruined this. It's all his fault.
Uh-huh.
He's like the King Midas, except everything turns to cheeseburgers and not paradise.
Hmm. I like cheeseburgers.
Everything that Jimmy Buffett touches turns to cheeseburgers. How great of a superpower would that be?
I don't know. That'd make for some really awkward moments late at night. So
it'd be great if you were hungry, but not so great if you just like wanted to watch your Apple TV or something.
Or blow your nose. So
you blow your nose into a hamburger. Buns can be absorbent.
No, but I meant like you touch your face and then your face.
No, I don't think that's the way it works. Did King Midas turn himself into gold?
I don't actually really know that I know the answer to that. not that that's important, because it's about King Solomon. Different king. And so they have to get off, and they parachute out, and the pilot's already left. LOL.
I kicked Tim Curry out the window, which is nice, because he can't jump himself, so they shove him out.
Yeah. And so they all get down to the ground, and they retrieve their stuff. The pilots are nowhere to be found. Sorry, Jimmy Buffett. And they
and then as soon as they land, they see another RPG blow up the plane that was apparently on autopilot.
Yeah. Well, my favorite thing about that is like you just see the one little RPG hit it, and then just kaboom, the whole thing goes up. And it's like that is literally what would have happened the first time that they were shot at. There wouldn't have been like this like firing 10 or 12 RPGs at them through this process. But they go on their little hike, and they set up a camp.
No way, man. I'm over my head, and I know when I got to turn back after the plane has blown up. Game over, man. I'm gonna take my gorilla and go back to Berkeley.
Yeah. And then Ernie Hudson points out, you know, good luck with that. I'm going on this expedition.
We're going this way.
Yeah.
Have fun with whatever you're gonna do, but I would advise sticking near us because it's dangerous here and boogity boo. People die and stuff.
Yeah. And so they set up a camp, and Laura Linney's like, oh, I've got air conditioners too. You want one? And she hands him a little box. She sets up a communications link and checks in with her boss, which is the first time that's happened. I don't know if he's just been like sleeping in the office or what, but he is always there, and ready to go whenever she calls. And so she has a little conversation with him, and then, Amy is roughhousing with Dylan. And, this is unfortunate because, there is no respect for personal property, and Amy destroys the transmitter and runs past camera before destroying the transmitter. Evil boss guy thinks that something bad has happened, and he has to send another expedition. Because it was the gorillas again, that is sad. And then Laura Linney is just like, ugh, thanks for ruining my stuff. And then Dylan's like, yeah, whatever, it was just stuff. Sorry, bummer, man. Because Dylan Walsh is like the worst, and has no empathy for anyone.
He's from Berkeley, and he doesn't believe in possessions, man.
God, hippie trash. So he's.
We haven't yet addressed Dylan Walsh's hair in this movie. I think the first thing out of Amanda's mouth, because she watched the first half of this movie with me, is that really his hair? It's horrifying.
I don't know what you mean. It seems very curly and bouncy.
It's basically like Weird Al's hair, but if you had like slightly larger ringlets,
I guess. It's very like, I don't know, Shirley Temple baloney curls almost. But they go through this they go through the jungle for a long time for no reason and talk about nonsense no one cares about. You go on their boat trip, and as we talked about, they have a little conversation during the day where Tim Curry reveals that he once saw a map in Soviet Jordan or Georgia, sorry, Jordan, Soviet Georgia, and he knows that the location of the city is Inj, and that it's supposed to be here, and it's King Solomon's diamond mine, and so he's been after it this whole entire time, and he knows that. Amy knows, and she pulls out the magazine thing, and Ernie Hudson says, you need to take your medication.
And then there's also that super awkward scene in their again travel montage where they're all trying to go to sleep and it's a full moon and all the monkeys are out in the jungle making noise and Ernie Hudson is sitting out there just like sitting in a chair smoking a cigar like, oh yeah, it's full moon, everyone out here thinks they're Elvis Presley or whatever he says. And then there, you know, there's the part where their hiking gets really hard because it's raining on their soundstage, and then there's that awkward close-up that shows like the giant pit of mud that a foot steps into, which is not even remotely shot in the same place or time as the other footage, but sure. And then there's your favorite while it's raining with the snake coming down from the tree where
it's so It is one of those throwaway shots that you would expect in like a 1940s we're going in the jungle montage.
Mm-hmm.
Like that, you know what I'm talking about. But back when it was acceptable to just have like this sort of like a colonial dark jungle, darkest heart of the jungle kind of vibe about things. You ever read Heart of Darkness?
No.
Oh. Well, don't start now, but it's basically like Apocalypse Now is basically an adaptation of The Heart of Darkness.
That's right.
So, and it's Kafka. So, anyway.
Who's Kafka? Tell me!
That was hilarious.
Great.
They have the dumb scene with the snake.
You know what else is hilarious?
What?
The time that they're camping and Dylan Walsh wakes up and he has a leech on his penis.
Oh, yeah, and then, you know, it's just like, help me get it off.
Ernie Hudson hands him his lit cigar, and he's like, here, burn it off with this. And then, of course, it takes like half a second, and he does it, and then he hands the cigar back to Ernie Hudson, who makes a face and drops it on the ground, because that's funny.
Yeah.
Comedy.
That's how you do it. So they have this exchange where they talk about the people who are standing there. The jungle.
Oh, you talk about the natives?
Yes.
There's natives here. And two people just like walk out of a bush, just stand there and they're like, hi.
Yeah.
They put the X on the ground right here, so this is where we're standing.
Yeah, and Ernie Hudson can converse with them and knows of them and that they are, you know, sensitive, but not dangerous. And again, this is some like 1940s like imperialist like stuff that we no longer do in cinema, but it's here. It's here alive and well in 1995.
Yeah, they should have stopped doing this in Crocodile Dundee. Was it 2? Or was it Crocodile Dundee 1?
I don't know.
But yeah, it's basically that same thing, except
I've never seen the Crocodile Dundee movies.
Oh, we're going to have to do one of those. The two guys come out and they're like, hey, we got a dead white guy in our camp. Does it belong to any of you guys? Do you know who left it here? Because we don't need it anymore. You guys can come get it or whatever.
And he had like, this symbol, triangle TC.
I'm going to draw it in the sand rather than describe it or anything.
Well, they made sure to bring in very clean sand for that soundstage, which is totally not what jungle floors are like.
I mean, they could have drawn it in mud. It would have worked just as fine. But yeah, no, the sand's easier to clean up on the soundstage.
Yeah, because one of the things that I find so really annoying about this film is how much of it feels like it's shot on a soundstage where they can control the fog machines and the plants and move and rearrange things so that it looks like they're in the jungle. But then you like pan down to the floor. And you see the sand that's obviously not part of a jungle, or
there really are like four wide shots, and the rest is like medium close ups because they can't, they're on a little tiny stage.
Yeah, and then sometimes when they're like, oh, we need to have a big expansive area. Okay, let's find somewhere in Southern California to shoot that where there's dry grass, and so that's totally like the Congo, where it is a rainforest. So I just. It's so lazy, the filmmaking here. But they just cut back and forth between all of these things, and it doesn't look like anything is even remotely close to any of the other things, like in terms of biomes or anything. It's just total nonsense.
Well, they only had $50 million to make this movie, apparently.
Apparently. But they go through this process with the quote-unquote natives, which is just horrible, where they go back and they see the chanting and everything, and they believe if they move him that the spirit will never return. And so they're trying to return the spirit to the body. And it's just like, again, horrible scene.
Yeah, there's a lot of chanting that doesn't line up with any mouths. It's all put in later. And, you know, theatrics and antics and what have you. And she knows the guy. And he's like, hey, it's that guy. And they're like, hey, snap out of it. What's going on? Snap out of it. Wake up. And then he doesn't wake up. And then Amy comes strolling in to see what's going on. And she's like, hey, guys. And then he finally wakes up and then sees Amy, the gorilla, and literally screams until he dies.
Yeah, well, I mean, he had his eyes open, so I think he was technically awake. He was just catatonic.
He was like a Cameron coma from Ferris Bueller.
He was in shock. And then he screamed himself to death, like you said, which does make a lick of sense, but whatever. And
well,
then the
spirit left him permanently.
Yeah, and then like you said, Ernie Hudson like took his pulse wrong in like three places, right?
Well, he's like, oh, he went limp. Like, let me grab his arm, and the arm is just like flopping around, and he just missed grabbing it like three different times. Like, wait. Oh, there's his pulse.
Yeah, well, there's
turn the camera. He's dead.
There are several levels of dead, Dan.
Apparently there are several levels of dead.
Yeah, and so they.
Turns out your friend has only been mostly dead all day.
Not quite dead yet.
The chocolate helps it go down.
Okay.
That's Princess Bride. Remember that movie, oh. Princess Bride, where he gives him the miracle pill and it's covered in chocolate?
Yeah. True love.
to Blave.
Yeah, to Blave.
Somebody bluffed a gorilla and it killed him. that's really all that happened to your friend.
I don't know about you.
With a gorilla and they bluffed and the gorilla tore his arms off.
I don't know about you, DC, but I do not want a bluff of gorilla.
Who do you think would win in a fight, a gray gorilla or Fezzik?
Are we talking about like in the Princess Bride world, or are we talking about in the Congo of this movie world?
I think we have to go with the Princess Bride world because Fezzik is a member of the Brute Squad, which is not really like a thing outside of their world. So okay. I'm gonna go Princess Bride world, but does that make it too easy because you know there's all the giant rats and stuff?
No, but it just means that Fezzik would automatically win because that's just how the physics of that work.
Okay, fine. Then what about in the other the other way? If Fezzik was in the actual Congo,
well, then I think you got a decent fight on your hand. Now, if it's the silverback that we see, then probably he has a good fight with Fezzik, and maybe you know could come to a draw, or maybe the gorilla might win, or maybe Fezzik might win. But if it was a situation where he was up against Amy, Amy's dead. And then if right. It was a situation where he was up against the gray gorillas in the city of Zinj, then Fezzik's dead.
You know, I just thought of an alternate ending for this movie.
Fezzik shows up.
Fezzik walks in. Hey, guys, how you doing? And just bops them all in the head with his giant fist. No. Should I save it for the ending? Mm-hmm. Or do you want me to describe now?
Save this wonderful juicy morsel to entice our listeners to not stop listening.
Okay. In case I forget, remind me that I have an alternate ending when we get to the ending.
Great, write it down. Get an index card. And so
my index cards are behind me because I got my field notes here. I'll write it down.
You didn't need to explain to me how you were.
Well, I got a new desk, Joe. My office has changed. My mic is on the other side of my desk. I'm completely thrown off.
No, but I mean, How did it help anyone to know that you were going to write down on like a different thing?
It's transparency. I want to be honest with our audience here.
No, you're supposed to encrypt that, Dan.
Right? PGP.
What are you pro FBI all of a sudden?
No, I got a key base. I know how to use the PGPs.
Okay. So I owe back to this movie. They hike along the rim of a volcano now. I don't know how the catatonic guy ran so very far away from the city of Zinj area where he was attacked, but apparently he did. They hack along, and she's all like, oh, I think we got to go right. And Amy's all like, no, this way. This is the way. Go
right, because her GPS thing stopped blipping for some reason.
Yeah, it just means that it went out. And he's like, oh, is that bad? And he's just like, it just means it went out, but probably bad. They see a plane get blowed up up above them, and she guesses that another expedition had been dispatched by what's his face, who was afraid to send his own expedition the first time, which is why she's there with them, but whatever. And then so
Yeah, they hike and hike some more, and then they find, then they actually come across that plane, and Ernie Hudson's like, you don't want to go in there. It's bad news. And they're like, well, I guess I don't want to go in there. But like totally later, she comes back and like takes all of the equipment from that exposition and uses it to like phone home again. But like, why wouldn't she take any of the stuff? Like her comms already broke. Like, why don't you go in there and see if they got their comms and call the dude?
Cause there is literally no reason why she wouldn't have tried to get the communication.
I mean, she wants to like wait till the bodies aren't so like bloody and like freshly dead or something before she goes in there.
Doesn't make any sense. And it's only for a dramatic effect. So they go through this process where they go past that and then immediately stumble into the city of Zinj, where it's like, oh look, it's the camp. Oh, I tripped over the perimeter thing. We've tripped over the perimeter thing, but where's the camp? Oh, there must have been hundreds of pounds worth of equipment here. Where did it all go? Where are the bodies? A mystery.
It's a good thing we get answers to those questions.
A mystery that is never solved. So nor did we need it to be solved or have it proposed as any kind of mystery. But
I wonder if there was some sort of humanoid-sized animal that's very strong and was able to move it or something, which we already knew that. Because, like, in her phone call with her boss, she got a heat signature of the...
She has video evidence of it happening, where there is a creature who could move
She
things.
Was there watching, unless she, like, looked down at her iPhone or something. It was like, huh, what happened? Did everyone just die? I didn't see.
She didn't have an iPhone. She had like a StarTAC or something, I'm sure. But so
no, it's, you know, she works for the government, so it's probably one of those Motorola satellite phones.
Oh, good.
Iridium.
So they, God bless you. So they have the one guy who goes over and he finds a wall that has a hole in it, and they go through the wall with a hole in it, which is way more convenient than jumping into a pond for no reason. Which is also weird because that hole that was there that he finds in like 2 seconds is like 3 feet from where Bruce Campbell was making his phone call earlier at the beginning of the film. Cause it's like right next to the camp, literally right next to the camp.
Well, you know, it's very thick jungle. So you go to the right and then you end up at the little pond that you swim through and you go to the left and you go around to the front entrance. You've never been to like a giant building where you're like right around the corner from the main entrance and you just couldn't find it because it was too big.
No. So, they need to know where the exit is because they're gonna have to leaf very soon from the jungle. But they
how long have you been waiting on that one?
2 seconds. I was just waiting for you to finish your thing about the exit thing with the turnarounds, which I didn't quite follow, but I was too busy making a pun. So it maybe I could have given you more brain power and the benefit of the doubt and really like followed you along on that journey.
No, it's fine. Let's Let's continue this journey into the city where Tim Curry...
Into the fog machines.
Tim Curry takes out his ring again and goes, like, look at the eyes on the statues. They're oval and gold, just like on my ring, so they must be from Solomon City or whatever.
Yeah. This must be it. This has to be the place. It's totally exactly the same. None of these statements are accurate. The eyes are kind of, like, they're yellowy orange. They just look like amber blobs. They were like, hey, Jurassic Park, do you have any leftover amber props? Sure, here, you can have these two. Okay, great, we'll use them fries. And so it's not exactly like yellow with the pupil slash thing through it, like the thing on the drawings, but whatever.
It's sparkly and magical, and over thousands of years it hasn't been tarnished at all in this jungle.
Well, you know, an amber eye like that, you don't tarnish all at once, or I don't know how that works. But
at least in Jurassic Park, they mentioned that you had to like clean off and like buff the amber before it would be clean enough to see. Anyway, they go and they find the steps. They go up the steps. What do they find at the bottom of the steps? They find like his candy bar or something.
Wrapper.
They find his candy bar. They're like, oh, yeah. We found this over here. And she goes rushing in because she immediately knows that this is exactly the kind of candy bar that my former boyfriend always carried around with him. He always had a Hershey's bar in his pocket, so I know this must be him, and he must be in there somewhere. So she goes rushing up the stairs into the Hall of Hieroglyphics.
Well, she's stopped by Ernie Hudson, who's like, no, we can't just like...
You ain't going in there alone, and I'm not going in there alone either, so everybody get a gun, we're going in.
Yeah, he's like, don't be John Wayne, again, with the references and the stuff, and the California Dreaming stuff, whatever.
like, this guy's from Africa, but I'm a writer from Southern California, so I'm just going to throw in some stuff here that I think the audience is going to appreciate.
Yeah, and so, but then for some reason they're like, no, but Richard, you stay out here with Amy and this other guy, Claude, and you guys are going to hang out. And immediately, I'm like, why would you do that? Like, you don't.
He's like, I don't want to go in there.
Don't split the party. And so they split.
They've never seen Scooby-Doo
or played D&D apparently. But they split the party, and this leaves the smaller, more vulnerable group outside, because there's one guy with a gun, a like flighty ape, and a guy from Berkeley. Who can't,
Amy really does disappear. Like every scene in this movie that starts with like daybreak, it starts with Dylan Walsh like rushing out of a tent, going, "Where's Amy? She ran away!" Like she does it like five times, and he always just like finds her again. So that's great.
And there's never like a conversation like,
"Don't run away from the tent." Either that, or maybe Dylan Walsh is just like a really heavy sleeper, and he just hates mornings, and he can't get up, and he wakes up at like 11 a.m. every day. He's like, "Oh God, I'm late for class, and Amy's gone, and I gotta find everybody. What happened?"
No, well, he just needs to set some ground rules, but it's I guess not really a problem at the end of this film. But so they go inside and they find all these hieroglyphics, which raises an interesting question, because King Solomon was historically a person who existed and was not actually from Egypt. So why that would be there, I don't know. And the Congo also not near Egypt, so. That's weird.
It adds to the mysticism, Joe.
It adds to the we're white guys who know two things about Africa, and we're going to rub them together really hard until we start a small fire.
Well, later they go on with kind of like the half cave drawing, half hieroglyphics kind of like hodgepodge of things. But they're like, we need a way to represent like an ancient language of words on the wall, but we don't want to spell it out, so because we need a delay between when they see it to when they translate it.
Oh, because they need to translate it too. So
sure,
it has,
of course.
That's why you want hieroglyphics, because we got the Rosetta Stone.
Well, I mean, that's apparently what Tim Curry's ancient book that he's been carrying around this whole time is.
Yeah, well, those are $600, Dan, for a Rosetta Stone course. You don't want to.
I know they're really expensive.
You don't want to just like leave that at home. You know, what if an emergency came up and you needed to know ancient Egyptian right away?
See, and I would go with the iCloud version, but then you would be out in the middle of the Congo and you wouldn't get a cell signal and you wouldn't be able to use your Rosetta Stone, and that would be a super bummer.
Yeah, but if you had lasers, then this wouldn't be a problem at all. So back to the central premise of the film.
You could connect up to your satellite and get telecommunications around the globe with lasers, and then you could get your Rosetta Stone in the middle of the Congo.
Yes, except they didn't have any of the online resources, I think, to do that back then. But
I think they probably had Encarta, right? Encarta was around in 95.
Oh, wow. I thought that was still on CD-ROMs, Dan.
No, it was still on CD-ROMs, but, a guy like Tim Curry R.B. Travis.
I just thought of something.
Yes.
Hey, DC, those were on CDs.
Yeah, that's the same letters.
I know, but it's backwards and forwards. Isn't that amazing? Well,
you know what else? You know what else about CDs?
Mm-hmm.
What do you use to read CDs?
Lasers.
Lasers.
It's all coming together. Illuminati.
He's going to go find a diamond to put in his laser to point at his Encarta 95 CD so he can read the hieroglyphics and translate it and find out that there's a bunch of white apes that are about to kill him.
Yes. And so
none of this is more far-fetched than what actually happens in the movie.
No, this is dreadful. So they
if
go
MacGyver
down
was here, he would absolutely build some sort of like rudimentary CD-ROM drive and read an Encarta CD.
Yes. I can totally.
And then he'd probably build an airplane out of bamboo or something, and they'd fly off the volcano.
I can totally see Richard Dean Anderson doing that, RDA as he is known. But so they go down to the bottom of the stairs where there's a big room with a crack in the floor, and it's like lava tubes. There's lava running underneath this whole place.
That must be how you get down to the mines.
Yes, and then the mines are sealed. We can't get in there. And then there's the minor earthquake trembly thing, and then outside. Richard's all like, oh, Amy ran away again. Convenient. And Amy is just like tooling around doing stuff. And then Richard's walking around, and then behind him, an ape. And cut to Richard running into the room they are in, screaming, covered in blood, saying, "Let me go, let me go, let me go. I need to run." And then falling to the ground, crumpling up dead, apparently, in 2 seconds.
He just falls down and he dies.
Yeah, and then the a head is thrown into the room from the ape who came in.
Right, whose head?
Claude.
We could assume. We don't really know.
Well, we didn't, like, linger on it, but I'm just assuming it's Claude since we don't see Claude anymore. Also, they've been losing, like, 2 porters every 5 seconds in this film.
Yeah, anytime they cut to Ernie Hudson, he's like, we got 2 more porters missing. Let's go find him. It's like, well, it's probably a safe bet that they're dead, but sure, okay.
Yeah, yeah. Well, so they should have brought stouts. So they go through the... You're welcome. So they go through the...
At least you didn't say IPAs, because I'm a fan of porters and stouts.
Oh, no. Well, I hate IPAs, Dan.
Yeah, they're terrible. People who drink IPAs are terrible.
Oh, they're garbage people. So the...
So you want to talk about the dramatic entrance of the gray ape that...
There's this horrible thing they do that is mind-boggling, that they even conceived of this as some sort of dramatic moment in cinematic history where they were just going to just freeze frame for a couple frames of part of the action that they were doing with the strobing and stuff and their slashing and things and smeary lens stuff and motion blur and you can't quite see what it is. And I have a feeling they were doing that because they were like, you know, it's not really that dramatic when this guy in the suit is trying to actually attack anybody. But at the same time, this does not cover up that fact.
No, no.
It they're like, draws attention to that.
When they were shooting it, they're like, well, let's speed it up so it looks like the ape is running really fast. They're like, whoa, that looks really bad. Let's like shake the camera around a bunch too so it's like looks really frenetic. Like, wow, that looks really bad too. So what else can we do that'll like really like mess with the image so people can't really see what's going on because it's crazy hectic all at the same time? But like, you know, still adds some energy to it. So they go with a strobe effect, which it's just like a bunch of blurry held frames of very shaky angles of a guy in a gray ape suit running at them. And then they just cut to the other angle, which is the whole group of people firing machine guns at the ape who just runs away.
Yeah. And like I said, I know they're trying to cover up the problem of what this ape looks like up close when they're trying to fight it. And they know that it looks ridiculous, so they tried to cover it up with this.
Although, like, in 5 minutes, they give up, and they're just like, show them what the ape looks like. Who cares?
Yeah, it's stupid. But if they wanted to actually try to, you know, have some sort of mystery, they could have done the whole thing in silhouette and then just, like, illuminated the front of it with, like, gun muzzle flashes or something like that for, like, a single frame, and then you see what it is, and it lights up, and it's just like, oh, there's this scary ape thing.
You know they know that trick, because later, when the guy gets his head smashed in, they do that quick, like, cut to black to sort of indicate they're like, oh, you don't want to see his head going splat.
Yeah, there are 5,000 different things you could do to do this scene better than how they did it.
don't do this, though.
Yeah, no, this is awful. Please never do this in a film ever again. And I think that's largely a reason why we've never seen anyone else do this.
Speaking of awful, amazing things, this next scene is so good. So bad, it's good.
You mean the part where they're like, where did the ape go?
No, I'm talking about the part where they go out and they set up camp inside the...
inside the city?
Inside the city, where they've got... It's this montage, like, dun-dun-dun-dun, where it's like all these cuts of, like, setting up the satellite and setting up the lasers and this and that. And my favorite shot, did you see the one shot where somebody sets down, like, a rectangular, like, lunchbox-looking thing on top of a rock, and there's just, like, a big scorpion sitting... like, a big fake scorpion sitting on the rock right next to the thing that they set down? It's like, yeah, this is going to look dramatic, because we're in the jungle, and it's just like, no... No, prop guy, whoever put that fake scorpion next to the fake box that doesn't do anything, I am laughing at you because that is horrible.
It is dreadful. Not as bad as the scene that unfolds, though, because...
No, because they get their lights, and then they're being surrounded by the apes, and then they turn on UV lights, and everything gets this cool kind of bluey look.
But they have lasers, which apparently act yes. as electrical fences.
Sure.
Because the apes run into them and stop moving and just shake their arms. Like right. They got caught in like an invisible fence or something and their collar has gone off.
This is where they basically stole the lines from Jurassic Park, where the apes are they're testing their boundaries or whatever because they're like running up against to see how close they can get before they get shot at. So they've got the purple UV lights.
And
they've got the blue
aliens.
Lasers. Right. Well, of course.
Because they've got the automated perimeter guns.
Sure, yeah, they've got the gun that is spinning around shooting at stuff based on whatever it sees, which apparently is, you know, on just like a janky little tripod, and it'll totally fall over and start shooting everybody, which is not great.
Yeah, well, you see, the thing is, when you see aliens and you know that the technology doesn't exist, you should totally put it in your film that's supposed to be taking place in modern day, and it's supposed to be for a communications company.
What I would like to know is who was carrying the giant automated double barrel machine gun turret on their back, like as they've been hiking through the jungle.
Not just one turret; they had several set up around this encampment. It doesn't make any sense. Like, if it was one thing where they had been like, oh, we found these on the plane, we didn't have these.
Which would have been a perfectly reasonable thing to do, because they were at the plane, and there were, like, boxes and bags everywhere, and they're just like, no, don't go in there, it's really gross.
Oh, we can't pick up these automated gun turrets, they've bled all over. but anyway, they...
the drink cart tipped over, and everything's covered in tomato and orange juice. You don't want to go in there, it smells terrible.
Oh, there's gin. Gin is the worst. Don't touch anything. But the thing
see if any of the club soda didn't spill, so we can get the stains out.
Oh no, it's tonic water. Ugh, gross.
Oh, worse.
But have you ever asked for like a vodka soda and be given a vodka tonic, and it's just like, whoa, God, what is this?
No, I don't think I have. But you know, can I get a ginger ale? Or can I keep the can? Is the thing people say.
God damn!
Can I keep the can?
What a good life hack!
I'd really like it, like two extra sips of airplane ginger ale.
What I really like though is how totally shaken up Dylan Walsh is by his close friend and partner, who he's done all this research with, and who's basically helped him raise Amy.
Yeah, he comes sprinting in with blood all over him and falls down at his feet, immediately dead. Mm-hmm. And he's just like,
yeah, whatever. And then he goes and he's hitting on Laura Linney. Up at Gun Turret Central, and she's like, "I'm the last line of defense, and my ex died, and I'm looking for him. He might still be out there." And then he's like, "That's great, Richard's dead. I like you." And then it's just like, "Why is the scene there?" I was so angry. After that whole scene, they're like, "We're gonna just camp through to the morning. First light, we're out of here." And they decide to go and leave.
Oh,
and
then, no. Don't forget, like, at the very end of that giant attack scene with all of the lasers and UV lights and flares flying everywhere for some reason, Tim Curry's been sitting in his tent the whole time, just, like, cross-legged in his tent, looking at his book, and then he comes out of his tent, like, covered in blood again from the head that was thrown at him. He's just like, "Hey, guys, I translated all the hieroglyphics. It says, we're watching you." And everyone's like, "We're watching you. What does that mean?"
And those hieroglyphics... we saw inscribed everywhere. I have translated them.
What do they say?
We are watching you.
I think that was supposed to be like a really dramatic moment.
It wasn't, though. It's just goofy Tim Curry comes out of a tent covered in blood. He's like, "Hey, guys.
I was translating hieroglyphics." So stupid. But then the next morning, Amy's gone again. They're missing two more porters.
Naturally.
And Tim Curry's missing. And so,
wouldn't it be great if, like, at the end of this, like, it turns out that Amy had been, like, secretly killing people all along?
She was killing all the porters.
Yes. She's been killing and eating porters.
Oh, it's terrible. So they go through the process of going... and trying to find everyone and where they went instead of just getting the heck out of there. This leads them inside the building again. Only this time, there's a violent earthquake. They see the higher... this is a different entrance to a different building, I think. Because then this is the one where they see the wall carvings.
This is where it's got the story, where it's got all of the drawings of upright apes wearing, you know, like those sort of like diapery bottom things from ancient Egypt. And they're doing things and they're killing people. And apparently they can all sort of intuit from these drawings that the King Solomon's people domesticated these gorillas to use as guard dogs. To protect their diamond mine, but the gorillas eventually killed all the people, and then they're the ones running around sort of protecting everything.
Yeah. Stupid. And so they see all that just in enough time for the volcano to erupt and the wall thing to crash and close the doorway, and then another porter dies with a statue on top of him.
And then they fall down a hole.
And then the floor caves in underneath them, and they fall downstairs, and then they run into Tim Curry, who's like, oh, I went in search of the diamond mines, and then I got trapped down here. It was just the worst. And then Ernie Hudson's like, get out of my way. And they go walk out into the area where we have another early digital matte painting, where there's a camera move and a matte painting, and it was just like, oh my god, this is magic. Because remember, this is 1995. And basically, matte paintings before this, I had to have a lock off with the painting because you couldn't move them both at the same time. But now we had computers, and you could do horrible sins. So they had the view of where you could see out the top to the top of the volcano mount, I guess, and then the sort of alcoves for the mines. It wasn't super clear if the apes just dug these that they could live in, or if each one of these is supposed to be like a mining tunnel. It's very weird.
Well, you've got the little tiny river, and you've got the orange sandy diamond mine beach or whatever. And like, maybe whoever wrote this like confused like diamond mines with like panning for gold or something, because there's like a little river where there's all of the sand.
Well, that's how they got so clean.
Yeah, of course. So you grab your little tin, and you fill it with water, and you just shake it around, and so you see the diamonds come out of the orange sand, which is just great. There's just giant, like, fist-sized diamonds just resting on top of the sand.
Yeah, and everyone knows that diamonds come out in these, like, perfectly faceted chunks, and not at all, like, how diamonds actually look.
They come pre-cut. I couldn't tell if that was a princess cut or what, but it was just sitting there in the sand, just waiting for Tim Curry to run up and start grabbing as many as he could.
Yeah.
And he's starting to turn into jealous we have the Holy Grail lady, and then he starts to run away, and then he gets surrounded by gray apes that smash his head in.
What's really dumb, because he says to them, we got to get out of here. We take as much as you can. You got to get me out of here, when he sees all the apes. And then they're like, yeah, we're looking for a way to get out. And then for some reason, he's like, I'm just going to start running around like a crazy person.
Why don't we go, like, back the way we came?
By myself.
Yeah. Sure.
And so, of course, that means he dies for totally stupid reasons. And then the other guy who was with them, he dies. But they
all die in the same way, basically. They get surrounded, they fall down, and then a big gorilla just like punches him in the head, and it explodes.
And then they get ripped up. And meanwhile, Ernie Hudson's like firing and stuff, but it's having very little effect.
It's having very little effect aside from like blood squibs exploding all over the place.
Yeah, and you get a lot of shots of apes emerging from caves, which would be dramatic, I guess, if they didn't look so absurd. Because these apes also apparently have some sort of like dermatological condition on their faces.
Yeah, they're kind of like albino, where they've got like a sort of freckly thing going on, but they've also got they don't have jagged teeth. They have like really screwed up like teeth that are falling apart. I guess it's supposed to be kind of like the human hybrid of like gorilla teeth and human teeth, but they're gray, and then they have really screwed up looking bodies.
Yeah, it's weird.
Feral. They're matted and feral.
Yeah, and so they, Ernie Hudson runs behind a boulder, and he's like, you guys go look through here to see if you can find a way out. And she's like, oh, wow, it's like a giant geode. And he's like, what do you mean? And she's like, it's like a giant diamond. I'm like, that's not
how geodes or diamonds work.
We're not going to leave it alone. Let's just go past this. And so,
are you familiar with diamonds, Dr. Karen Ross? Because I don't think you are.
We should have given the writers for this a copy of Encarta. But she goes through to the special room they have in the back, where all of a sudden we're at the temple at the beginning of Indiana Jones.
It's where they keep their dead human skeletons.
Yeah, and also their like seemingly fresh cadaver humans that they haven't done anything with.
Sure.
There's two of them.
Maybe the geode is like really good at insulating, and they kind of use it as like their meat refrigerator. Mm-hmm. So they store the bodies in there, and then they eat them as they become hungry, but they just leave them in there, and then eventually it's just, you know, bones and stuff.
Yeah, and he was remarkably well preserved. But something tells me that's because they wanted to have Bruce Campbell be recognizable and not torn up into shreds.
It's kind of recognizable.
Yeah, well, and he's holding one of those special diamonds, and this gives her the idea that, oh, well, no, he's
holding one that is not, like, fresh and clean like all of the ones that Tim Curry had found for some crazy reason.
No, his is in a rock, and she gets the idea to smash the rock against another rock.
Right, and then she yells, give me 2 minutes! Because, yeah, you know, they're getting surrounded, and, you know, they go to town shooting all the apes because they're running out of bullets, and she takes the laser gun out of her backpack, which she had with her,
yeah,
and then smashes the gray rock against the other rock to get the fresh diamond out of it.
They did not establish, to my satisfaction, that she was carrying that around the whole entire time.
No, not at all.
So
apparently diamonds are coconuts in this, and you just smash them against a rock and get the diamond out.
Yeah. But you know what they say, Dan? Diamonds are a girl's best friend. And so she,
especially if you're going to use that diamond in a laser gun to kill like modified apes that are trying to kill you.
Yeah, to just mow down apes.
She mostly just like cuts off appendages. She doesn't really like go for headshots or anything.
Well,
she
like slices some of them in half.
Yeah, she's swinging around kind of violently.
Yeah, I don't know about like awarding accuracy points here, but she's pretty darn effective with a laser.
I mean, it's not the most humane way to put down a psychotic gray ape.
No, but of course we can't gloss over Amy coming to the rescue. She comes back in.
All right, because Dylan Walsh gets like knocked down and captured, and he gets surrounded, and you think like, oh, they're gonna smash his head, but they're
no, of course not, because they're moving far too slowly for that.
Very, very slowly, because they're like, oh, we're really running out of energy after we just smashed those other guys' heads. So we'll take our time with your head.
And Ernie Hudson's gun is jammed, and so Amy's like, no. Stop, Dylan, friend, Amy, help, Amy, hug. And it's just like, this is preposterous. Because we also know that the apes had been smashing all of the normal apes because there were all those skeletons that they found. And we're like, these are normal ape skulls that are totally crushed. So obviously, whatever relationship they have with the normal apes who seemingly live 50 feet away is not a good one. But for some reason, they're incredibly fearful of Amy. I would assume that's because she can talk. But that doesn't seem like it alarms them when it comes to humans.
They're totally violent and crazy and whatever. And, like, I don't know, if it were reversed and if it was, like, a bunch of people and somebody came out and was like, no, don't kill him. They'd be like, who are you? We don't know you at all and you're trying to stop. We're just going to kill you, too. Like,
maybe
they
were just very confused and they were waiting to see how the whole thing played out. They really were not expecting the lasers. But...
I mean, nobody ever really expects a laser, do they?
Nobody expects lasers. And then that happens. Chekhov's laser gun, which
God, we almost glossed over the best part. When she gets her laser gun operational, she comes running out of the tunnel, and do you remember what she says?
What the hell are you doing anyway?
What am I doing? I'll tell you what I'm doing. We're getting out of here.
We are. What about Bam?
Put him on the endangered species list.
Put him on the endangered species list.
Yes.
And starts blowing him out with the laser gun.
Oh, God, what a line.
Oh, God. You know, when the screenwriter wrote that, he did a fist pump in the air, and he's like, you know what? This is going to be so great.
And then he did another
line. It's
going to
be in the trailer.
He did, like, two more lines of coke, because that was such a good line. But they did all that. Then they run out of there, back up to the top, and... somehow, and things are really exploding now.
Yeah, just in time for the volcano to erupt and come like rushing through that opening at the far end of panning for Diamond River. And then like the apes, some of them are like in the path of the lava and they're getting burned.
Did some
and then
of them there's jump all in?
The
other,
what is going on? Why are they're like pushing each other into the lava and they're jumping into the lava? Couldn't tell if they were like backed into a corner and they're like, oh no, the lava's gonna rise and like kill us, like we gotta get out of here, and they were just freaking out. Or is like, why is there some sort of like instruction that you had, like pact that like when the volcano goes off, you have to dive into it to like kill yourself and erase any sort of memory of what was going on here, like hide the evidence? Like, what is going on here?
I couldn't explain it, but there's so much lava and so many apes jumping in it. But it's so weird. They get out of there, back up to the top. Of course, the ground is splitting on the soundstage because that's like 100% necessary.
Sure, there's a variety of like jumping over canyons and like grabbing onto the ledge and being pulled up and being saved, and then oh no, the ground is slanted and we got to hang on to each other, and Dylan Walsh is hanging on to Amy, who's hanging on to like a root or something. Mm-hmm. And then you know, Laura Linney, you know, cleverly uses her laser gun to cut down a tree which lands perfectly across the canyon so they can get up and walk across and be safe again or something. It's very just like, well, we've got this sound stage and there's going to be lava and falling apart Earth. What can we do?
Just ridiculous. And so they get out of there. And they go, like, again, like 50 feet back to Southern California field.
The crash plane. And she's like, go look for the white box with the red stripe. That's going to be the hot air balloon.
I love that line.
What?
Because I just love that line because it's like, did she have one and they just didn't bring it with them?
Well, no, you remember Joe Pantaleone said, like, you know, we got you everything except the balloon and something else. And she's like, yeah, it's fine, whatever. Mm. So it was on her manifest earlier, but they just kept calling it the balloon. You're like, the balloon? Why is she bringing a balloon?
Yeah, I think I had not really categorized that as anything relevant to the story.
Maybe a weather balloon or something to attach their cameras or lasers to.
Yeah, so she's like, she finds the transmitter and the hot air balloon. She sets up the transmitter, which is something she could have done a day ago. They quickly get in touch with the guys back over at the communications place, but there's some momentary tension because it's raining there, and oh no, satellite technology, which made me laugh for a second because, like, really the dramatic tension that you have right now is that you have some guy with some water that is dropping the water in front of the camera. Like, that is dramatic tension.
The movie's over too, so we don't need any more dramatic tension.
No, it was ridiculous. It was just like, just have him call. And so they call and they chit chat, and he's like, did she get it? Did you get the diamond?
Don't you regret the diamonds? That's the most important. She's like, I'm trying to tell you that your son died. And he's like, who cares? Did you get the diamonds? That's the most important part. And she's like, remember when I said that if you sent me here to get diamonds instead of to get your son, that I would make you pay because you're a total jerk. And for some reason, I have this moral line in the sand, even though nothing really had evidenced in that regard earlier. Well, but she's like,
she had made that weird demand at the beginning of the film, which is so peculiar because it was very obvious in that scene that he didn't give two craps about his son. And that he only cared about the diamond, and yet she's like, if I suspect that you don't care, and it's like, you should suspect now, before you even do anything else, now. Like, he's literally smashed in a TV screen because he's angry about diamonds. Like, the guy does not care about his son.
His name is R.B. Travis. You can tell he doesn't care about anything because he is a rich Texas oil magnate. Well, telecommunications magnate. Yeah.
Well, so anyway, she's like, I'm going to get you back. I bet this is like pointed at the satellite right now. And it's like, of course it is, because that's how you'd be talking to him. and she's like, I'm going to put the diamond in. And he's like, you can't do that. There's like 12 jillion chip things in the thing, and it'll destroy everything. And she's like, I'm going to do it. I'm going to get you back. You need your new source of money. Here you go. And then she fires her laser at the satellite, and it blows up.
What would happen to the satellite if I put its phone number in this laser, Aaron, and pull the trigger? The chip from the transmitter's got the satellite's number, doesn't it?
That laser takes a 12,000-channel chip. If you put all that power through that diamond, Todd!
This is for you, Charlie.
Like, real genius, I guess, but in reverse. It doesn't explode into popcorn.
I'm going to shoot down your multi-million-dollar satellite because you're a jerk and I don't like you. And I mean, I guess at this point she's like, you know, tendered her resignation or whatever because her former boyfriend is dead and her boss is a jerk. And she barely made it out alive, but she's going to make sure he pays by doing something that is probably a major violation for the FCC. So she's probably going to get, like, arrested or sanctioned at least when she gets back there. But
isn't space like international, like free zone area?
Probably, but I don't think you can just go shooting lasers willy nilly up into space, knocking people's satellites out of the air.
Sure, you can, Dan. Star Wars, Ronald Reagan. Let's go. Pew pew.
That worked out super well, didn't it?
Lasers. Ask upgrade. So anyway, the thing is that she does this, and then they get the hot air balloon, and then Dylan Walsh says goodbye to Amy in the California field.
Right, because there's been like probably two or three other times in the movie where Amy has come across a family of like regular apes, and they've been sort of like dismissive of her, and she got sad for a little while, and then there was another time where she like said hi, and they didn't immediately scare her away. So apparently she's found a family that will adopt her, so she's going to go, she's home now, she's going to go live here forever in the wake of this sort of volcano, and she's home again finally, so yeah, she's good.
And so Dylan Walsh goes with them on the hot air balloon, and he's like, I picked you a daisy.
Oh my god, I love that. That's just taking off, like he's holding the flower that Amy gave him, like just holding onto it and looking at it very dramatically, at least two shots. Like, dude, it's a flower from a grill. You can let it go, man.
There is a shot of him that I love where he's standing there covered in dirt with his perfectly curly hair, holding the flower in one hand and then the diamond that he's given in the other hand, and he's smiling like an idiot, and she's like, get rid of it, throw it as far as you can. It's just like, couldn't you just throw this as far as you could off of this? You're in a hot air balloon.
You know, she couldn't bring herself to do it because the diamonds are a girl's best friend, and she couldn't throw her best friend off of a hot air balloon, so yeah, she asked Dylan Walsh to do it.
Dylan's diamonds are forever. And so,
I mean, you know, given that she just like gave up her job and probably like part of her retirement package, she should have just kept the diamond and like hawked it on the black market.
That was my first thought, was just like, you know what would really actually be good revenge? To sell this diamond that you went
or just use it to start your own life and or like scientific research center that isn't run by a jackass named R.B. Travis.
Yes, that too. Or you could just sell it and just like retire to, I don't know, Malta. I have no idea. But there are so many things that she could have done. But she's like, no, this wasn't worth it. Throw it away. And then Ernie Hudson's like, oh, shucks. Look at all that money.
It's it's blood diamond now. All the people who have died to find this diamond. Like, so also, are we to assume that like in the many thousands of years that this city has been there, just in the middle of the jungle, that at no point the volcano erupted to cover it all in lava? Or is this kind of the thing that like every so often the volcano covers it in lava, and that's kind of like how it like regenerates all of the diamonds?
It's how the game resets.
Are we to assume that like they just happened to get there at this one point in all of history right before it was going to be completely demolished and covered in lava, and oops, it's completely gone now. Solomon City is completely buried under lava.
According to the way this movie is shot, it appears to be a complete coincidence because there is no lava damage to the city other than cracks from earthquakes where they can see the exposed lava tubes. But there is absolutely nothing that dramatically ties the explosion of the volcano to the events of the film. That it just happens exactly timed to the story. So it's stupid. It's so lazy and ridiculous. Like, it's not like they like went down there and there was a giant diamond that they shouldn't move, and then that altered the flow of the lava, and then it finally went off. Like, none of that.
Oh, that actually would have been a reasonable thing to do.
There are, well, I mean, I don't really think that's how lava flows.
No, but yeah, they could have come up with some sort of, again, pseudoscience nonsense where they moved a thing, or they disturbed the ancient something or other, and now that the lava's coming out.
Or the laser hit something and knocked open a magma tube and flooded the whole city or something.
Oh, sure, it's a very powerful laser. Maybe like somebody tripped and fell, like, you know, earlier when the gun turret fell over, and they blast a big hole in the side of the mountain, and then the lava comes running back down that hole towards them.
Yeah, I mean, no, but
you know, just have fun with it. You know, come up with something.
There's so many things you could think of. Just in 2 minutes.
I kind of want to remake this movie. Just make it all the more insane.
I would only do it if I could do it as a comedy where you're just like completely trashing the first film.
I mean, it's pretty funny as is.
God, this is why I wanted to do the film, because I had this recollection, because I'd only seen this the first time in theaters when it had come out in 1985, and I was a kid, and I did not like it then, and I knew that it was ridiculous, and I've read all the stuff about how ridiculous it was over the years, but I was just like, you know what, I really want to revisit this, because it has less than 2 stars on Netflix, and it is on Netflix now, so what content manager at Netflix was like, okay, fine, I'll agree to put this on the service. Like, whatever you say, just give me something else good, Paramount. Just give me something else good, and I'll put this piece of crap there. I can't imagine anyone was like, you know what I want? Congo. Let's go to the mat on this. Let's fight tooth and nail over every penny to get Congo. Like, I feel like this is just something that gets put into a package deal that no one can get out of.
Yep. Can I tell you my alternate ending now?
Oh, yes, please.
Okay, so...
I'm glad I reminded you.
Thank you. No, I wrote a note. See, it's sitting right here on my thing. Mm-hmm. Okay,
did you write it on your index card?
I wrote it on my field notes.
Oh, yeah, because your index cards are behind you, right?
They are, because I got a new desk.
But your field notes are in front of you.
That's correct, because that's where I wrote my notes. Okay. Because based on all of those episodes we've done where I describe my process, my quote-unquote process for watching movies.
That is good. I'm glad that everyone knows this and we're transparent.
PGP. Okay, so... The reason this mine was such a big deal back in the ancient days, and the reason these monkeys are insane, when they get there, they discover they're not diamonds, they're crystal meth. And the monkeys have been smoking the crystal meth, and that's why they're super fast and super violent and crazy. And they're really disappointed to find out that it's just a place where crystal meth naturally occurs in the earth.
You've been living in Arizona too long.
No, but doesn't that explain sort of the feral state for these apes?
I don't know. It just seems like if you had something like that, then they wouldn't use it for their communications laser because it would break.
No. See, and breaking would be bad. That's the thing. That's when they get there and they realize that this whole mission where they've lost everyone is for naught because what they were actually looking for is not here. It's really just a bunch of hopped up, meth-addicted apes that are going to kill everybody, and they're not even going to get their diamonds out of it. Although, if you wanted to go like Cartoon Network on it, you could have her do some of the meth to sort of get like rage powers too to fight back.
Did you not hear my pun about Breaking Bad, or did you hear it and you were like, I'm just going to go past it?
Cause no, I didn't hear it at all, because it probably went right over my head.
Okay.
You want to do it again?
No, I don't. The moment has passed.
Okay. I didn't really watch
it. But yeah, she could totally do meth, and that would be the thing at the end of the film from 1995.
It could happen. It could work.
Mm-hmm.
That would at least be one of the few logical things that actually occurs in the movie.
Where would they get the pizza to put on the roof?
Let's see. I didn't see any tomato plants, but they could probably find some. They could probably put some in there because they're very sort of loose with the actual foliage.
Yeah, I'm sure they just run over to the greensman and just ask him.
Sure. I mean, maybe there's a spot on the other side of the volcano where, you know, basil and tomatoes grow.
Yeah, or they just drive to Van Nuys and they're like, we need one of those.
Okay. Sure. Why not? The quote-unquote natives have a traditional meal that is very reminiscent of pizza.
Of course. Oh, dear. So anyway.
Can't believe we watched this movie.
I knew I wanted to do it because it was going to be bad. And did it deliver or what?
It certainly delivered.
It was either this or Supernova. Did you ever see Supernova?
I'm not familiar with Supernova. What is Supernova?
Oh, God. I can't even summarize it. Just watch the trailer for it, and it's just stomach-turning. But you know, there's some other things. Like this week, because I've been listening to a lot of, let's just say, music from a certain time in my life.
Oh, dear.
Because I've been ill, and when I was out sick for a couple days, I was just like listening to Amazon Music nonstop. And when I couldn't go to Disneyland this weekend, I was listening to Amazon Music nonstop, and it was just the 90s alternative station. And one of those things that got me thinking was like, wow, we really should do Orange County sometime. Remember Orange County?
Yeah, the TV show, totally.
No.
The movie. You mean the movie?
Yes, with Colin Hanks. Yeah.
That movie is something else, man.
That movie's not that good.
No, I remember seeing it back then and going like, wow, I feel like this movie has something profound to say. And then like a day or two later, you're like, no, it doesn't. it doesn't do anything other than, you know, there's Colin Hanks and Jack Black and stuff.
And then you could tell immediately also after seeing it that, oh, everyone just agreed to be in it because this is Tom Hanks' son. Because it's got like John Lithgow and Lily Tomlin. And you're just like, you were all like, yeah, Tom, we'll do whatever you want. Because there's no reason why anyone else would show up in this. Poor successful Colin Hanks living successfully in the shadow of his father.
He's doing all right. He's got that show. Is that show still on? I forget.
Which one? Mad Men?
No. He's on. He was on one of the Life in Pieces.
I've never heard of that.
It comes on after something else I was watching, but he's in it.
Yeah, after something else, but before something else.
No, I usually see the intro to it at the end of my DVR on something else.
What is it that you're recording in the DVR?
I don't know. It probably came after like New Girl for a couple episodes or something. I don't know if it's still on.
Ah, okay. So it was a Fox show, so it's probably canceled.
Probably.
So that concludes Congo.
Congo.
Mm-hmm.
1995.
Just dreadful commercial vomit movie.
I mean, it's fun if you want to make fun of it.
Mm-hmm.
That's about it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeesh.
Oh, you know who we were just talking about, like what a successful producer they were?
Yeah.
Do you know who produced this?
No, who produced it?
Kathleen Kennedy and Sam Mercer.
Oh my God, that's right. I saw her name in the I like to think she had minimal involvement in this.
Oh, it doesn't seem that way, does it? But, yeah.
I mean, given the things that she is able to do as a producer, what did she do in this one?
She was the producer.
Yeah, I know. But what did she do? Did she just show up to set and drink because they were making a horrible, horrible mistake?
I have no idea. But in an interesting connection, Frank Marshall was an executive producer on Who Framed Roger Rabbit, which is our movie last week.
It's good for him.
Yeah.
He produced a lot of things.
Did you see Arachnophobia?
Long time ago.
He directed that.
Hmm.
Let's see, what did he do after Congo? He did 8 Below in 2006. So from 1995 to 2006, that's a big gap. And then the rest of his credits are all producer credits.
Yeah, he's got a lot of good producer credits.
He knows how to pick successes that he doesn't direct. He also produced Jurassic World. Oh dear.
He was second assistant director on Temple of Doom.
That's probably why he's such a good buddies with Stevie Spielberg.
Stevie.
Yeah.
I produced Goonies, Back to the Future, Young Sherlock Holmes, Color Purple, Money Pit. Wow, man, he had a good run here.
Yeah.
Let's see what he did surrounding this movie, producing wise.
Not directing.
The Indian and the Cupboard came after this.
Hook.
The Best of Roger Rabbit. I'm unfamiliar. That's direct to video, apparently. Sixth Sense.
That was a series of animated shorts they did, I think.
Hmm.
Yeah.
Tiny Toons Adventures, Fievel's American Tales. Good.
I never saw Signs. Everyone said it was ridiculous.
It's terrible.
Yeah.
It's the worst.
Mm-hmm.
Alien Invasion, and they throw water on them.
Spoiler alert.
It's basically the whole movie. Oh, spoiler. Sorry. Yeah. It's terrifying. When that reveal finally comes that the water scares away the aliens, you're like, oh my God, you got me there, Shyamalan.
Oh. Indiana Jones and the Kingdom of the Crystal Skull. Oh. Let's put this movie in a refrigerator and eject it into a nuclear explosion or volcano.
We can drown it in a river next to an orange beach full of diamonds.
Yes. And then set off the nuke that restarts the core of the Earth with the Dinty Morse do.
Sure, but you gotta just drive out the other side really fast.
Yes.
Sheesh.
Furiously.